All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a look at a Fourth Amendment case. And this one, well, it's a bit of a head-scratcher. Segura v. United States, 1984.
Ooh, yeah, Segura, that's a good one. Classic. Really gets at those tricky situations where law enforcement might, you know, maybe overstep a little, maybe even enter a place illegally. But then later on, they get a warrant, everything's by the book. So the big question is, does that initial entry kind of poison the well? Does it make the evidence they find with the warrant inadmissible?
Exactly. And for all you aspiring legal eagles out there, especially those of you deep in the trenches of Crim Pro, this case is a must-know. You're going to encounter these scenarios more often than you think. So mastering the exclusionary rule, especially those exceptions like the independent source doctrine we're diving into today, well, it's crucial. It could make or break your case someday.
Absolutely. You got to know when evidence is tainted, when it's not. It's all about those fine lines.
So let's rewind the clock back to 1981, February 12th to be exact. New York City, the DEA has their eyes on a couple of individuals, Segura and a woman named Liz Marina Cullen. What was it that initially piqued their interest? What put them on the DEA's radar?
Well, it started with those whispers on the street, informant tips, alleging that Segura and Cullen were mixed up in some shady dealings, drug trafficking to be precise.
Yeah, the classic informant tip. But it's rarely enough to go on alone, right?
Right. You need more than just hearsay. So the DEA did what they do best. They put Segura and Cullen under surveillance.
Stakeouts, tailing suspects, all that cloak and dagger stuff. Classic.
Yep. And that surveillance, it did yield some interesting observations, but the real turning point came with the arrest of two individuals connected to Segura and Cullen, Rivudala Vidal and Para.
Ah, so we have a couple of associates enter the picture. And they weren't just hanging out, were they?
Nope. They were caught red-handed with cocaine, and not just any cocaine, mind you. The DEA had reason to believe it was directly linked to Segura.
Okay, so we're starting to build a case here. But it seems like those two arrests, especially Rivudala Vidal, they really blew things wide open, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Rivudala Vidal, he started singing like a canary, spilled all the beans about a drug deal, directly implicating Segura as the source of the cocaine.
So now we've got informant tips, surveillance, and a cooperating witness placing Segura at the heart of this drug operation. It sounds like we're getting pretty close to probable cause for a search warrant, right?
You would think so, wouldn't you? But hold on, there's a twist. It was already evening by the time Rivudala Vidal started talking, February 12th, and for whatever reason, a magistrate wasn't available to issue a warrant right then and there.
Ah, so we have a delay, a bureaucratic snag.
Exactly, and time is ticking, right? So the assistant U.S. attorney gave the agents an instruction, a rather interesting one. He told them to secure the premises.
Secure the premises. That's a pretty loaded phrase, isn't it?
Right.
What exactly did that entail in this case?
Well, they found Segura in the lobby of his apartment building, and they arrested him right there. Then they went up to his apartment, and get this, they entered without a warrant.
Whoa, hold on. They entered the apartment without a warrant. That's a pretty bold move. And of course, huge Fourth Amendment implications, right?
Absolutely. And it didn't stop there. Once inside the apartment, they arrested Cullen and then proceeded to conduct what they called a security check of the place.
A security check?
Sure.
And I'm sure they just happened to find some incriminating evidence during this so-called security check, right?
You guessed it. They saw drug paraphernalia right there in plain view.
So we've got a warrantless entry, an arrest, a security check that magically uncovers evidence, the makings of a Fourth Amendment challenge brewing.
And just to be clear, they didn't have a warrant for any of this, right?
Nope, not at this point. And it gets even trickier. They stayed in the apartment for, get this, 19 hours.
19 hours. They basically camped out in Segura's apartment without a warrant. That's right. It wasn't until the next day, February 13th, that they finally got a warrant to formally search the place.
Okay, so 19 hours later, warrant in hand, they conduct their search. And I'm assuming they found more than just drug paraphernalia this time.
Oh, yeah, they hit the jackpot. Cocaine, 50 grand in cash, ammunition, records of narcotics transactions, the whole nine yards. But here's the million-dollar question. What was the basis for that warrant? What did the agents present to the magistrate to justify it?
That's the key, isn't it? Because if that warrant was based on anything they saw during that initial 19-hour, let's call it what it is, illegal occupation of the apartment, then that evidence is tainted, right? Fruit of the poisonous tree.
Exactly. But here's where it gets interesting, and this is where the independent source doctrine really comes into play. The Supreme Court, when they later reviewed this case, they made it crystal clear that the warrant application rested solely on information the agents had gathered before they ever set foot in Segura's apartment.
So let's recap, just to be absolutely sure. That means the informant tips, the surveillance they had conducted, the arrests of Rivadala Vidal and Parra, and most importantly, the statements those two made implicating Segura, all of that was already on the table before the warrantless entry.
Precisely. They didn't use anything from that initial entry, that security check, in their warrant application. It was all pre-existing information.
Okay, that's a crucial distinction. So even though they messed up, arguably, with the warrantless entry, the warrant itself was clean, based on a separate, independent source of information.
Exactly. And that's the heart of the legal issue the Supreme Court had to grapple with. Does that prior illegal entry automatically taint everything that comes after, even if they later obtain a valid, independent warrant?
In other words, does the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine apply here and make that warrant obtained evidence inadmissible?
Precisely. The defense argued quite forcefully that it did. They said this was a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment, that the initial entry poisoned everything that followed and the evidence should be thrown out.
But the Supreme Court, they didn't see it that way, did they?
Not exactly. In a 5-4 decision, they ruled that the evidence obtained under the warrant was actually admissible.
And this is where the independent source doctrine takes center stage. For those who might not be familiar with this legal concept, can you break down exactly what the independent source doctrine is and how it applies in a case like Segura?
It's actually pretty straightforward. The independent source doctrine basically says that if you obtain evidence through legal means, and those means are completely separate, completely independent from any prior illegal activity, well, then that evidence is fair game. It's admissible.
So even though the police might have messed up initially, if they later managed to obtain the same evidence through a legitimate independent source, like a valid warrant based on pre-existing probable cause, the court won't automatically throw it out just because of that earlier misstep.
Exactly. The focus is on the legality of the final source of the evidence, not necessarily the path taken to get there.
And this is, of course, an exception to the exclusionary rule.
Right. The exclusionary rule, as we know, generally says that evidence obtained in violation of the Constitution, like through an illegal search or seizure, can't be used in court. But the independent source doctrine carves out an exception for evidence that, even though it might be connected to some earlier illegal activity, was ultimately obtained through a completely separate legal channel.
It's like having two separate roads leading to the same destination. One road might be riddled with potholes and detours, but if you ultimately reach the destination through a completely smooth, well-paved road, you've arrived legally, haven't you?
That's a great analogy, and that's exactly how the Supreme Court viewed the situation in Segura. The initial warrantless entry, that was the bumpy road. But the warrant, based on pre-existing probable cause, that was the smooth legal pathway to the evidence.
Now, while we're on the topic of exceptions to the exclusionary rule, it's worth at least mentioning the attenuation doctrine. How does attenuation play into these situations where there might be some connection between illegal police conduct and the discovery of evidence?
Ah, the attenuation doctrine. That's a whole other can of worms. In a nutshell, attenuation kicks in when there's a causal link between the illegal action and the evidence. But that link is so weak, so attenuated, that the taint of the illegality is considered purged.
So, for example, if the police conduct an illegal stop, but hours later, after the suspect has been Mirandized and given access to an attorney, they confess to a crime, that confession might be considered sufficiently attenuated from the initial illegal stop to be admissible.
Exactly. The taint of the illegality has dissipated over time. Now, you could argue that the 19-hour occupation of Segura's apartment might be seen through an attenuation lens. After all, that was a pretty lengthy and arguably illegal seizure. But the Supreme Court and Segura, they really focused their analysis on the independent source doctrine, the fact that the warrant itself was based on information completely separate from that initial entry.
Right, so the court didn't really dive deep into the attenuation question in this case. But it's worth keeping in mind that attenuation is another tool in the toolbox when evaluating the admissibility of evidence that might be connected to some earlier illegal activity.
Definitely. It's a complex area of law, and there's often overlap between these different doctrines and exceptions.
Okay, so back to Segura. We've established the facts, the legal issues at play, and the Supreme Court's decision. Let's dig a little deeper into the reasoning behind the court's ruling. What were the key arguments made by the majority, led by Chief Justice Berger?
Chief Justice Berger, in his opinion, he hammered home this point. The warrant was based entirely, 100%, on information that the police already had before they even thought about stepping foot in Segura's apartment. He emphasized that the illegal entry did not, in any way, shape, or form, contribute to establishing probable cause for the warrant.
So the majority was really focused on this idea of an independent causal chain. The evidence wasn't found because of the illegal entry. It was found because of a valid warrant, which itself was based on a wholly separate and legal foundation.
Exactly. The illegal entry was basically irrelevant in their view. As far as they were concerned, the evidence was discovered as a direct result of the warrant, which was properly obtained and untainted by the earlier shenanigans.
And Chief Justice Berger, he also addressed some pretty important policy considerations, right? Like the balance between deterring police misconduct and ensuring that criminals are brought to justice.
Right. He argued that throwing out evidence that was obtained legally through a valid warrant would simply be going too far, especially in a case like this, where the warrant was based on completely untainted information.
So the majority was basically saying, look, we get it. We want to deter police misconduct, but tossing out perfectly good evidence isn't the way to do it, especially when that evidence was obtained through lawful means, independent of the initial mistake.
Exactly. In their view, suppressing the evidence in this case wouldn't really serve the purpose of the exclusionary rule, which is at its core about deterring future violations of constitutional rights. It wouldn't teach the police a lesson because they didn't do anything wrong in obtaining the warrant itself.
Makes sense. Now, of course, not everyone on the court agreed with this decision. Justice Stevens, he wrote a pretty strong dissent, didn't he?
Oh, he most certainly did. Justice Stevens, he was really troubled by the fact that the agents basically occupied Segura's apartment for 19 hours without a warrant. He argued that this was, in itself, an unconstitutional seizure, a blatant violation of the Fourth Amendment.
So for Justice Stevens, the problem wasn't just the initial entry. It was the fact that they essentially took control of Segura's home for an extended period without any legal justification.
Exactly. And he raised a really important concern, one that we still grapple with today. He worried that the majority's ruling could actually incentivize police to engage in warrantless entries, knowing that they could later cure their illegal conduct by simply getting a warrant based on information they already had.
So Justice Stevens was basically saying, hey, if we let the police get away with this, they're just going to be more likely to do it again in the future. We can't let them think they can just barge into people's homes and then clean it up later with a warrant.
Precisely. He saw this as a dangerous precedent, one that could undermine the very protections the Fourth Amendment is meant to provide.
Okay, so we have this split on the court, a close 5-4 decision, and a really important debate about the limits of the exclusionary rule and the potential consequences of allowing seemingly tainted evidence into court. Now, Segura didn't explicitly lay out a step-by-step test for applying the independent source doctrine, but what are the key factors that courts typically consider when faced with this type of scenario?
Well, based on Segura and subsequent case law, the analysis usually boils down to two main questions. First, was the warrant truly based on information obtained before the illegal entry or action took place? This requires a close examination of the timeline of events, the information presented in the warrant application, and the testimony of the officers involved.
So we're talking about a rigorous factual inquiry, really digging into the details to see if the police had enough information to get a warrant before they ever crossed the line.
Exactly. And the second question is, was the warrant genuinely untainted by the illegal activity? In other words, did that illegal entry in any way influence the decision to seek the warrant or the magistrate's decision to issue it?
So if the police saw something during that illegal entry that then became a crucial part of their probable cause, or if the illegal entry itself prompted them to go get a warrant when they wouldn't have otherwise, then the independent source doctrine probably wouldn't apply.
Exactly. The taint of the illegality would still be there. The key is that the decision to seek the warrant and the probable cause supporting it have to be completely independent of the prior illegal activity.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground here, from the facts of the case to the Supreme Court's decision, the reasoning of the majority in dissent, and the practical implications of the independent source doctrine. So let's step back for a moment. Why does Segura matter? Why should our listeners, especially those future lawyers among them, care about this case?
Segura is important because it clarifies the boundaries of the exclusionary rule. It tells us that not every instance of police misconduct automatically results in the suppression of evidence. If the prosecution can show that the evidence was ultimately obtained through a completely separate legal avenue, then it's likely admissible.
So in a sense, Segura gives law enforcement a bit of a safety net. If they can prove they had a legitimate, independent basis for obtaining the evidence, they might be able to get around an earlier mistake.
Right. It emphasizes the importance of building a solid case, of having multiple sources of information and following proper procedure, even when things get messy in the field.
Now, this obviously raises some important policy questions, right? Does Segura strike the right balance between protecting our Fourth Amendment rights and ensuring that the guilty are punished? Justice Stevens clearly had some concerns about that. He worried that this decision might actually encourage police to engage in illegal entries, knowing that they could potentially fix it later with a warrant.
Absolutely. It's a delicate balance, and there's no easy answer. But it's a conversation we need to keep having. How do we ensure that law enforcement respects constitutional rights while also giving them the tools they need to effectively do their jobs? Segura forces us to confront those tough questions.
It certainly does. So for all you law students out there, here's the key takeaway from Segura. Whenever you encounter a situation where the police might have overstepped their bounds but later obtained a warrant, your analysis needs to focus on the independence of that warrant. Was the probable cause truly established before the illegal activity? Was the decision to seek the warrant completely untainted? Remember, the independent source doctrine is a crucial exception to the exclusionary rule, and it could be the deciding factor in whether or not key evidence is admitted in your case.
And one final thought for our listeners to ponder. Given the complexities and potential loopholes we've discussed today, how might the Segura ruling affect police behavior in the real world? Does it create a dangerous incentive for warrantless entries? Or does the potential for suppressed evidence still act as a strong enough deterrent? These are the kinds of questions that legal scholars and practitioners continue to debate. There's no easy answer, but it's a discussion worth having.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Segura might be a case from 1984. But its implications are still felt today. It's a reminder that the law is constantly evolving, and that even seemingly settled principles can be challenged and refined as new situations arise.
And that, my friend, is what makes law so fascinating.
Couldn't agree more. Well, on that note, we'll wrap up this deep dive into Segura v. United States. Be sure to join us next time when we might explore another fascinating exception to the exclusionary rule, the inevitable discovery doctrine. It's a close cousin of the independent source doctrine, but with its own unique twists and turns. Until then, keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.